Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
And our guest today, we have an author and a doctor, and he's written a book. I believe it's his first book, called Primordial, and our guest is Dr. David Sobel. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's really a pleasure.
Well, it sounds like you have a background in as being a doctor, a surgeon, and now you're writing as well. What made that happen? Like, how did you get from doing what you do to becoming a writer?
So my history is even a little more sordid. I was a lawyer before I became a doctor. Practiced law for 3 years and then decided that I was going to go and become a doctor. As far as writing, you know, I've always enjoyed writing. I've always enjoyed telling stories. I will tell my patients now that, you know, medicine is really all about telling a story. We meet with the patient, we get, we collect a history from them. Sometimes we'll do studies to kind of get a closer look at things. And then we put a story together that makes sense. I've always been an avid reader. I thought, well, this is a challenge. This is something I want to try to do and piece together, weave together a story that goes from beginning, middle, and end. And that's what I hopefully did.
Well, that's you know, it's interesting that you were first a lawyer, then to a doctor. I mean, what was your intention as a person? Like, what were you thinking when you were before becoming a lawyer and doctor and that professional career thing, kind of where was your mind at then?
Well, you know, I joke that I was raised to become any kind of doctor or lawyer I wanted to be. And so I became both. To be fair, when I went to law school, I was young and I liked the idea of it. I know this sounds crazy, but I was probably rebelling against my parents a little bit. My dad was saying I should go become a doctor, and I was going to show him and be a lawyer instead. I will tell you, I absolutely loved law school. I thought it was fascinating, and the practice of law was really not for me. The day-to-day practice of law, I think it's an incredibly challenging profession. I feel very fortunate that I was able to pivot and find medical school and then drill down. I'm a urologist. I specialize in sexual medicine. I'm very, very happy in my day to day. With that said, I still have a lot of friends who are lawyers, and they're the smartest people in the world, and I love going and having dinner with them. I just, the practice of law itself was not for me.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you don't know till you're out there and you're feeling it out and seeing what you like or dislike. I'm sure, but it gives you a lot of training for doing research and things to write a book.
Certainly, it helps with research. The writing, again, when you're writing a brief, when you're presenting, a story to a judge or a jury, when you're, I did a lot of transactional corporate work. Even that, there were storied elements to it. So, absolutely, it helped. And in my book, there's, the main character is the general counsel. For a hospital. And so there's a lot of legal aspects to it, including some malpractice aspects to it. So I have absolutely no regrets. I truly enjoyed my education. It's helped me immensely. But boy, am I happy that I don't practice law.
Especially in these times, crazy. Yes. So I wonder... when you talk about having a history as being in medical and legal, and I look at the storyline, the characters must incorporate a lot of yourself into these characters.
There's a urology resident who's a character.
Right.
I guess I would say I'm not as brave as my characters. I'm not as good looking as my characters. I don't think I'm as smart or as witty as my characters, but I hope that there's a little bit of me in some of them. So I think that's probably a natural process. Again, this is my first novel, so I don't come at you with a... I'm 20 books in, and I've created 100 different characters, and I can give you backstories left and right. This was a very natural, organic process, and so I think you're probably right. I borrowed a little bit from myself, but there's a lot of fantasy. Wish I was taller, wish I was better looking, wish I was smarter and as good as my characters.
Well, yeah, but how we see ourselves is always different than others. So, you might be all of that and you don't realize it. but that's interesting. So it's kind of a weird process getting into writing a book and putting it out. What do you think it was that, let's say, give you the courage to actually think that you could write a book and publish it? Like besides, of course, just doing it, but what, because you really put yourself out there by doing something like this, right? It's just like, especially in the world today with social media and everybody has access to you easily. So it kind of, when you actually decide to write a story and publish it out there, you kind of are exposed. What do you think? There's something or a catalyst for that for you to make that happen?
So I have to say you're absolutely correct in that, and I didn't fully appreciate that when I started, and then very quickly it kind of snowballed. Like the thresholds of where's my comfort level and what am I trying to achieve. I am a professional. I'm out there. I'm a surgeon. I operate on my patients. I didn't want to throw something out there that would be embarrassing. The book has been really well received within my hospitals and by my staff. But I remember when it came out, there was a real amount of anxiety that I didn't want people to go to it and just, I wanted to sort of pass that litmus test that, okay, this is a coherent story. This makes sense. This was entertaining, and yeah, it's, you do feel incredibly vulnerable, When in most other aspects of your life, you know, especially as a surgeon, you can control a lot of your life. And in this aspect, it was putting myself out there in a way that I've never done before. What's interesting, the book, the chapters are very short and punchy. And ironically, you know, there's a reason for it. The book was written as I was a practicing physician. So, you know, it's 3 a.m, I'm in the emergency room, I'm waiting for a CAT scan to be done, and I pull out my iPad and I could, you know, I knew where the story was going, I knew what I had to go, what had to happen next, and I would sit down and do another chapter. And so this really was a process of one step at a time. I had my physician assistant who we shared an office at that time was wildly helpful because I would finish a chapter and I'd say, well, here you go. What do you think? And I'd get that sort of instantaneous feedback. And so this whole process was woven together, you know, one chapter at a time with the global understanding of I knew where the story was going. I knew what I had to do next. And then I just had to sit down and do it. But you are absolutely correct. When it's time to sort of just put it out there, there's a lot of vulnerability, stuff that I wasn't prepared for.
Yeah, it's an interesting cycle, you know, because when you first do that, because that's what I was saying, I was kind of tying that you put a lot of your own experiences into characters, whether you consciously think about it or not. I mean, we all do. I mean, as writers, it just sort of comes out. Our actions and reactions are, you know, they come from our experiences. So you kind of put some of yourself out there. And it takes a lot of courage. I don't think people realize what you kind of will go through. And same as the ratings come and as people start to review you over time, sometimes it's a lot of it makes you deal with a lot of stress sometimes that you didn't plan on.
It does. I think in some ways it makes you a kinder, gentler person.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully it does. Again, it's, you know, look, there's nothing special to that vulnerability. I think anytime anybody puts themselves up, an artist paints a portrait and puts it on a wall, there's that moment of self-reflection and am I good enough and did I do this right and should I have done this differently and what are they going to think? And, you know, we all have an internal voice and it just starts, you know, it just starts running in hyperdrive. But then you get through it and you get to the other side of it. And I think it's all a worthwhile process. I mean, this is about putting yourself out there no matter what you do.
Well, speaking of inner voices, when you write, Hal knows where I'm going with this. Do you feel that, did you find that you, as you were crafting these characters and writing the dialogue, did you find that you have like an inner monologue in your head? Or did you find that you had more, translating more images and symbols as you were writing this? I know I hear voices. That's the joke.
Yeah, I actually hear voices as well, and it's an inner monologue. And I think part of the challenge is you want to maintain the character's voice rather than just giving it your own. Hmm. And because I found myself sort of translating everything into my own voice. There were... You know, the book bounces backwards and forwards in history, and my mother's so happy I have Nazis in my book, and so you know, part of it happens in a concentration camp. I will tell you that, you know, I took about a 3-month break between the chapters are interspersed, but initially it was written in sort of 3 parts, and. And I wrote the whole sort of, you know, 1940s concentration camp in one fell swoop. But I took about a 3-month break before I tackled that. And that was really, you know, there, you know, I could write about a lawyer and I could write about a doctor in current times. And I had a lot of fun with that. There's a scene during an autopsy, and that was a lot of fun to do. That's language, that's dialogue that I'm comfortable with. I know these people, but I felt wholly unprepared to do, you know, concentration camp stuff. And that was really the challenge, is to, you know, is to now create characters that from a bygone time, and how would they talk, and you know, how do you push the story forward, and do you even have the right to touch this kind of topic, you know, and the tragedies in this, you know, in this era. And that was, so talk about voices. There were a lot of voices of doubt during that time, and a lot of struggle getting dialogue during that time.
Well, you're in a hospital, so if you get out of control with the voices you hear, you're too far.
Yeah, I can get a mandatory 24-hour admission.
You're close by. Perfect. You know, you have a good medical plan. So you bring up that story about that, because I guess the idea of going back to the Nazi time was kind of a big part of the book of searching for a soul, finding the soul and the, you know, and evil, that sort of thing like that. What made you go in that direction? Because someone from a doctor's point of view is usually very scientific, medical and all that. So what made you go for the soul?
So to go a little bit further back, in college, I was a religion major, and I've always been fascinated by faith. And then as you talk to people truly of faith, their belief in the soul and the transcendence of the soul. And so from a medical standpoint, to imagine that there are primordial cells within the body that house the soul, and potentially being able to find those cells, I thought that made a lot of sense of bridging faith and science. You know, the mechanism of going back to, you know, to Nazi Germany, well, again, that's all about you know, evilness and a desire to find those cells and commandeer that soul, and having, you know, tragically a long list of victims that you can experiment on, you know, that helped propel the story. But I do think it was an interesting bridge of faith and science that those cells may actually exist.
Well, it's pretty interesting. Where does an idea like this come from, do you think? Like, was there something that happened in your life or somebody you know that kind of led to this kind of idea?
I remember having the initial seed of the idea all the way back in medical school. And I think medical school is a profound time, because you're taking an ordinary citizen and you're really throwing them up against, you know, the human body. They're grappling with issues around existence and death and what happens, you know, from your first semester, and you're working with a cadaver. You know, it's an interesting process, I think, for any medical student. And there's this ongoing transition that happens through training and residency, and finally as an attending. So, I mean, there were seeds of it. I think a lot of it, you know, when you're in a hospital late at night and you're talking with friends and everyone's telling stories, I think the fascinating thing is, as rooted in science as we all were and as we all are, you know, we always gravitated to those stories of things happening that we couldn't always explain. You know, the aspects of medicine that surprised us, the patients that did well when we never thought they would. You would meet someone, and as a physician, they just absolutely believed in the transcendence of the soul. And as you press them on it, it was their experience with death and dealing with patients and seeing them both, you know, before the life was extinguished and then afterwards. And, you know, it, these things just percolate. But it's, you know, it's a fascinating process as a physician in training and what you go through. So, you know, I think it's a, in some ways, I think it's a very natural process where these things percolate and you wonder about these aspects.
Yeah, well, it's in today's world, I wonder, you know, there's a big anti-science movement or, you know, there's a lot of issues since the pandemic and other things going on. Does that worry you or how does that affect you?
So it worries me and it's something that I just don't understand. I truly think there's enough room for faith and God and religion within today's science. I don't think one excludes the other. There's so much that we don't know. There are so many things that we can't explain. There are forces that are, you have gravitational and nuclear and electromagnetic forces that we know are there. We don't understand, you know, we understand we can predict them, but, you know, God can live within those particles and we can explain a lot. So I'm very concerned about the anti-science movement. You know, I'm here in Colorado. I'm part of the university. We took COVID very seriously. The state of Colorado is, apparently we have crossed 70% in vaccinations, but I have friends who've gotten incredibly sick from the disease. I know people who have passed away from the disease. You know, we took it very seriously as we should, and we applied science to it. And I don't think that needs to be exclusive of faith and religion. I think that someone can very easily say that if they truly believe in faith and religion, that God may have steered, you know, these scientist hands to help them develop a vaccine that is this effective this quickly. That's something I can get my arms around. I don't know why it has to go to, you know, God gave me an immune system and you know, and I can fight off a virus. And if I can't, well, then that's God's will. I don't know why it has to be that dichotomy. I think science has enough room for religion.
Well, I heard if you had vitamin B and lavender oil, you'd be okay.
Oh, well, if you do it as an enema, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you know. I'm sort of surprised. I didn't see it coming the way it did. It seems to be a big event, and some states are worse than others, of course, but... it's crazy not to take advantage of what we do know, you know.
I agree completely. The one thing that gives me comfort is that when you look at history, you know, we've had waves historically of anti-science sentiment that has sort of grown and blossomed and then retreated. So we've been here before. If you look at the foundation of the American Medical Association, it was in response to these waves of anti-science and charlatans that came out and were selling snake oil. And so, I mean, it's sad to say, but as an American people, we've been here before.
Yeah. It's kind of a process we keep going through. Wow. So, what's your writing process? Like how, you know, other than waiting for a CAT scan, do you sort of have a system of how you like to write or what you like to do to get yourself in the mood to write? Or is it do you outline things? Like how does that work for you?
I did outline. I you know, when I sat down, I knew the ending, and I found that to be incredibly helpful.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So I had a roadmap on where I was going. I also, you know, I have some friends who they wake up every morning at 5 a.m. and they write for an hour no matter what. And I've never been that kind of a person. Again, my chapters are short. So, you know, when I sat down, I knew what I wanted to do in that chapter. I knew what needed to come next to keep the story moving forward. And so I would sit down and then just finish that. And so I like to sort of put a bow on it and be done. So each chapter was written within one sitting, sometimes multiple, but at least each chapter, I wouldn't stop in the middle of a chapter. It would be written in a sitting. It would, you know, I'd review it. I'd kind of polish it up. I'd get to a place where I'm comfortable with it. And then I would send it out to friends and family and say, well, what do you think? And that was part of the process. I didn't wait until I had everything done and say, here you go. I was getting feedback from people all along the process. Now, as far as like sitting down and writing, that's kind of how I did it. Revision is something completely different. And boy, writing a book is so much easier than revising a book. That really surprised me.
I was wondering, with going back to the concentration camp scenes that you had to write, what type of research did you need to accomplish those scenes? And did you need to decompress, because it's, you know, such a dark part of history? Did you need to find some way to decompress once you were finished?
So there was some research. Again, this is fictional, so I did pick up some books on Nazi doctors and do some research on Nazi orphans and immigration to the U.S. and the like. And the research is fun. I mean, you're poking around in history and you're getting a sense of it. Again, that was the most difficult part of the book to write, because again, it fell back to sort of that inner voice in mind, you know. I was talking to my kids the other day, and I said, my inner voice, you know, is fairly nasty and kind of mean. And you know, the inner voice there is saying, you know, what right do you have to you know, create characters and tell a story from a Nazi concentration camp, and overcoming that and just sort of pushing forward through that. And it is pretty dark. And then you talk about being vulnerable. You know, I am uncomfortable with some of my patients have found the book and they've read it, and you know, it's like, oh, Dr. Sobel, you can get pretty dark sometimes. And yeah, it's a dark part of the book. So there's that vulnerability as well. You know, do I have a right to do this? Am I going to do this well? And then how is this going to be received, and how will people look at me after doing it? So I took time off before I tackled that part of the book, and then I took some time off after that part was done. And that was a lot of, you know, show it to people. And again, I ended up intercutting the chapters, but if you can think of that whole, you know, concentration camp section as one third of the book done, that was sort of handed off to people and, you know, give me your honest feedback. What do you think? And is this, you know, am I capturing something? Am I doing a disservice? How do I need to change this? You know, I don't want to offend anyone, and yet I want to tell this story. So that was the most intimidating part of it.
Yeah, you have to be careful. It's a fine line. You don't want to let the, as we say, noise around you change your direction or change, you know, you don't want to concentrate on the outside too much.
There's a lot of people who I ignored when they gave comment, and this wasn't like I didn't go online and just throw it up and say, you know, give me your feedback. There were some choice people. Again, my physician assistant was wonderful. My family, I have a friend of mine who's a phenomenal doctor, Steve Grant in Vermont, and he was incredibly helpful. So I had a number of people who I leaned on. My cousin's husband is a voracious reader. And so I was like, well, he, you know, I kind of threw it at him and tell me what you think. And Jack Moore, and he came back with so many wonderful notes. So there are people I ignored, and there are other people where I was like, wow, this is insightful and this is wildly helpful. And so that all lent itself to the revision process, which was, again, difficult, but necessary.
Always is. That's always the hardest, the most grueling.
I know, but I wish you would have told me that before I started.
It's my fault. Your characters, so where do they come from? How do you create your characters? Are they people you see in a coffee shop, someone you've operated on, a neighbor? Like, where does it come from for you?
I don't think it's any one person, but certainly it's people that you bump into day to day. And again, one of the great aspects of being a doctor is you really get to know people on an intimate level, both patients and colleagues, because you're in the trenches and you're going through some stuff together. So it is an amalgamation of people that I've met. There's, the protagonist and then his two helpers. I knew I wanted this circle of three. Each of them have probably a little bit of a few people that I've met in the past to set a tone and create a personality. That was my process. I will tell you, I did sit down and I was told, oh, you have to really understand these characters backwards, forwards, upwards, down, and create this giant backstory and do all this stuff. And I spent a weekend and I put out all the main characters and I went through that, and I found it both frustrating and helpful. I didn't like doing it. It felt silly doing it because I had already been living with these characters. I was probably halfway through the book, and yet I found it to be helpful. It does add a dimension to them.
Yeah, it's an interesting process. So when someone picks up your book, they pick up Primordial and they read it. What is it you hope they take away from that book?
You know, it is a medical thriller. It's not a work of literature. It is really a story. And so I hope that they enjoy the journey, and I hope they enjoy the story of it and the turns and the twists that come along with it. I think that there are some, when you see a movie or read a book that was really good and impactful and you enjoyed and it stayed with you, I guess there's some aspects of it that I want to stay with people. And this idea of the soul residing in those primordial cells, I think it's a fascinating concept. And you know, you can sort of noodle on that for a while. And there is the other theme about evil and what makes somebody evil. And there's a scene in it where they're talking about that exact thing. And it was funny because I was doing surgery once and we were talking, I was with all, in an operating room, there's anesthesia and a scrub nurse and scrub tech and a floating nurse. There's a lot of people in the room. And we started talking about gun laws in Colorado. And a lot of them were actually have conceal and carry. And so we started talking about, well, why? What are you afraid of? And bad people. And well, don't we have laws and the like? And sort of the conclusion that we all talked about was that the laws are there not to contain bad people, but to contain good people. Because we all, if we wouldn't get caught, and it was funny, these are high functioning people. These are lovely people in society. And we all sort of agreed, if we knew we wouldn't get caught, would there be some laws that we'd be willing to break? And it's the fear of getting caught that keeps the good person in line. And yet the evil person, keeps marching forward. And so themes like that were woven throughout the book, I think are bigger themes and probably for people smarter than me to figure out. But certainly they made its way into the book.
Well, so do you plan on continuing this as a series kind of thing? Do you want to go further with this and write a second book to this? Or do you think you put an end to it already?
So it's funny because I've gotten some great reception and great feedback for the book, and the response is they want another medical thriller, and I think I from my standpoint, I wrote a medical thriller because I had an idea and it worked within that genre. And I wonder if, do I now get pigeonholed as, well, this is my genre? But at the same time, it's what I'm most familiar with. So, I have started working on a second medical thriller. Again, it's an idea that works within that realm. And I think it's worthwhile to keep some of those characters, but giving more screen time to some of them. And working through this next, challenge that they have. So I'm not looking for a series where we keep banging up against the primordial cells of the soul, but I do think it makes sense that I have an idea that works within the medical landscape, and these characters can really take the story and run with it.
If you could do another genre, I'm just curious as to what that would be.
I guess I would say I wonder too. I have a few ideas that just fall within a drama category. Don't have anything to do with either a thriller or medical thriller. And it's been nice to sort of go back and look at my outlines for that and wonder about it. Ultimately, I think I will, you know, I will go back to that other just straight drama. But at this point in time, it feels a little safer, and I think it makes a little more sense to stay within this lane. The challenge was, look, I'm a practicing physician. This was a phenomenal exercise, and again, things have been received really well, and it's been a nicer process than I ever thought it would be. And then you get a little bit addicted to it, and you're like, oh, you know, I can do this once. I want to see if I can do this again. And so I think it's about challenges. So I think writing a book is one challenge. I think writing a second book is a whole other challenge that's really difficult to achieve. And then I think the next step is going outside to a different genre. And I'd like to do all of that.
Interesting. So do you have any influences in the writing world? Are there any writers you just love to read?
You know, I'm going back a while. I've always loved John Irving in drama. And, you know, people always say, well, you wrote a medical thriller. Who are you in that science realm? And I've always appreciated Michael Crichton for, you know, taking a kernel of science and then just blowing it up into an incredible fiction. And so I think, again, so to be clear, do I believe that the soul resides in a cluster of primordial cells? I don't. There's a lot of science within the book that, you know, kind of makes sense if you were to search for them, and what would those cells look like, and how would you go about that search, and what would you do? So I like the application of science and then just blowing it up into a much larger fiction.
Oh, so maybe you can write into a conspiracy theory.
I'm living through them right now.
Well, that's what I mean, you know, it might be a good indication of it. What would you suggest, because you're a new writer and this was your first book and your first process and going through all this stuff, what would you say to someone who's thinking about doing the same thing as you?
The short of it is, if I could do it, I don't see any reason why anybody can't. I think it's a mountain that is scalable. And I think it needs to be taken in small chunks and just keep trudging up that. It's absolutely doable. It takes a lot of work, and there's going to be moments of real disappointment, but at the end there's a manuscript and you can put it on a shelf and you can say, you know, with great pride, you know, you scaled that mountain. You did it.
Okay. Now, I wonder, do you have a website, or do you have a place that you want people to come find out more about you?
You know, the book is up on Amazon. I'm a little bit of a shy recluse, and so the thought of my kind of funny mug on a website got me a little queasy. So I haven't done that, but my wife keeps getting on me, so I'll say in the process.
We'll just put a picture of Brad Pitt or something.
You know something? Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
You know, patients always say to me, they're like, you look like that guy, that Hollywood guy. And I know exactly what they're thinking. They're thinking Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
And I'll say to them, I'll say, you mean Brad Pitt, right? And they're like, no, not Brad Pitt. You don't look like him. Who's that guy you look like? And then I finally tell them. And this is nothing against Elliot Gould. He's, you know, I'm honored to look a little bit like him, but boy, do I wish I looked more like Brad Pitt.
Well, you know, they don't need to know that, you know.
Right.
just take a picture and stick it up there. Anybody, use Dave's.
No, yes.
You don't want them running.
Yeah, you don't want that.
Yeah. Well, That's it. I was gonna say too. Now you working in the medical and going through this whole pandemic and all of the weird stuff in the last year and a half, 2 years, and even maybe a few more years. But being on the front line, I wonder if does the stress of a medical big issue like a pandemic, does that affect you in your writing? Do you think that that sort of stresses you out, or does it make it darker, or does it make it, or do you have no problem with it at all?
So it certainly impacts things. Well, first off, the amount of free time to sit and write. You know, it's funny, people will say to me, so what'd you do with your pandemic? With this thought towards, did I learn a second language, or, you know, did I do all these things with free time? And, you know, I joke, I'm like, well, I went to work every day. You know, we just kept on working. So there was, in many ways, less time. But you're right, your psyche is impacted. I don't think, I think it was harder for me to get into that sort of zone or that framework where I was ready to write. And when I did, I think it was a little, you know, the elbows were sharper and the like. I don't think it has been my best time of writing. You know, again, this is where you sit down and you force yourself. You know, pandemic, I was just talking to my wife how, you know, how much the perception of it changed. You know, early on when, you know, we were calling our kids back from college, and no one really had any concept what was happening. You know, you want to freak out your wife. You know, I'm sitting on an iPad watching videos on how to manage a vent. And she's like, what are you doing? And I said, well, my hospital wants anyone who's had surgical ICU experience to, you know, reintroduce themselves to vent management. Remember, I'm a urologist who specializes in sexual medicine. That got her scared. There was a lot of anxiety that we were all feeling, and no one knew where this was going. It's a very difficult landscape to then sit down and say, all right, I'm going to create a fiction and tell another story. You know, we were living through, you know, our own science fiction and our own drama. So really, really difficult time.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, I you know, especially being in part of it, being part of the more of the front line, you know, I would be, I would think that it would sort of seep in, you know, it'd definitely be in the back of your mind when you're trying to describe events in your book.
It's certainly, yes. It's certainly a darker, it takes you to a darker turn. Now, to be fair, at this point I was doing the revision. So, and the revision is, you know, was in my opinion, the more challenging aspect. You're throwing stuff out that you fell in love with, and you're trying to put stuff in that you may not, you know, love as much. And you're just trying to make sure everything is cohesive and makes sense. I wasn't creating the idea from cloth at this point. And so in some ways for me, you know, it was a break from that reality. You know, I could put myself into my basement and sit down and say, all right, I'm going to go through five chapters, and let's make sure this is working, and let's be comfortable with this. And, you know, I knew what had to be done. And then I just had to be careful that I wasn't too cynical when I was doing it.
Yeah, that can be hard. Wow. Well, it's just been a great conversation, and we're glad you came and spent some time with us. And we'll have your book up on our website as well, so people listening can do one click and find you. Wow. So the book we're talking about is Primordial, and our guest is the author, Dr. David Sobel. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, David.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.